I am Nat Hewitt, and welcome to the Rogue Monkey Podcast.
Hello, listeners and viewers. Thank you for joining us for episode 95. My name's Kevin, and I'm the host of the Rogue Monkey Podcast. For anyone new to the show, our podcast is here to share those stories that will help you find your way, personally, professionally, or academically. We speak to people from all walks of life and explore how they have overcome hurdles and navigated their journey on the path to ultimate success. Today, we're excited to welcome to the show Nat Hewitt, who is an award-winning director and producer and has been making primetime documentaries and series for major terrestrial and international broadcasters for more than a decade, including the BBC, Channel 4, and National Geographic. We will leave Nat to share the details of her journey, but what we can say now is that Nat's work has taken her quite literally to the ends of the earth, and her story is both captivating and inspiring. Just before we start, make sure you've hit subscribe, however you're joining us today, as that helps the podcast grow and reach more people. And be sure after the show to check out our new Etsy store, where some of our favourite quotes from the show are available in beautiful clean print format, allowing us to continue growing and investing in the show. So, we're going to get straight into our conversation today and our 95th episode, featuring award-winning director and producer, Nat Hewitt. Nat, hello. Welcome to the podcast. How are you doing?
Hi. Thanks for having me. I'm good. It's great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for making the journey out from London to join us today. It's interesting, and we were talking before we started recording about how paths end up crossing and how you end up where you are, and I guess that's what we want to talk about today. So give our audience, our listeners and our viewers out there just a bit of an insight as to who you are and a little bit of an overview of your journey.
Oh gosh, yeah, where to start? So I'm Natalie Hewitt, I'm a documentary director. I've been making films for sort of UK and international broadcasters for over a decade. I don't even want to count actually how many years it really is. And I actually sort of started out working on kind of, you know, science programmes, that kind of thing at the BBC, and then I later on realised that I was actually most interested in making kind of documentaries, and I'm really, really like human stories. I'm very interested in humans and people and who we are, what makes us who we are, what makes us tick. So I kind of moved towards doing more of that. And so now I spend my time mostly making documentaries for lots of different things. So at the moment I'm working on a few different projects, one of which is a documentary about the discovery of the wreck of Endurance, which I filmed last year in Antarctica.
Well, we're going to pick that up on a separate episode, I think, next year once everything's out in the public, and we're obviously very excited about that. But let's go right back, because we've had quite a few people on the show who say, I knew exactly I wanted to be a pilot or a footballer or whatever it is. Whereas your story is kind of the opposite to that.
Yeah, I'm so jealous of those people. Like, whenever I was a kid and I was in class with people, and they were just like, you know, you get to that age where everyone's like, yeah, so what GCSEs are you going to do? What do you want to be? And I never knew. I just never knew what I wanted to like be when I grew up. And I was really jealous of the people who knew they wanted to be a vet or a lawyer or a doctor or a hairdresser, you know, whatever. And I kind of, it used to really worry me. I was like, oh gosh, maybe there's something wrong with me because I just don't know. But I did know that I wanted to do something creative. I was really interested in that, and I was really interested in kind of self-expression and that kind of thing. I went and studied theatre at university because I loved storytelling, and I loved theatre. It was one of my real passions. But I sort of very quickly realised that even though I'd been a sort of middling to average actor when I was at school, and it was kind of a larger fish in a smaller pond. Once I got to university and I was sort of with some quite serious actors, I realised I was basically terrible at acting. And that's kind of the one thing I thought I maybe wanted to do, and I realised I was not very good at it. So that kind of cue another existential crisis of like, what am I going to do with my life? But I kind of never let go of this thing of wanting to do something creative. And I think by then I kind of really realised I wanted to tell stories. I kind of was starting to realise that was one of the things that I really loved about theatre and about drama. And I sort of took a bit of a detour after university. I went and did an MA in Chinese studies, which is a bit of a long story in itself. But when I finished that, I'd sort of still had no answers about what I wanted to do. But I had a friend who was working at the BBC at the time, and she was kind of like a PA to one of the big bosses at the BBC. And we went for coffee one day in London, and she said to me, oh, you know, well, why don't you do the same as I am? Like, why don't you get a job as a PA at the BBC? Because, you know, you could get to know the organisation. It does so many different things. Everything's sort of radio, television, film, events, you know, I don't even know if they were doing podcasts at the time. But, they did so many different different things. And within each of those things, there's so many different job roles, whether it's production management or producing or directing or whatever. So I thought, oh, okay, yeah, I'll do that. Because I'd always loved the BBC. I remember as a kid, I think I must have been about 9 or 10, and we, like, one half term, we went on a family trip to London, like me and my parents and my sister, and we went to London, stayed in a hotel, and we each got to choose a thing to do that weekend, you know, in London. And I chose to do, like, a tour of the BBC, because I'd always thought it was a really cool place. And I remember walking through the doors, like the spinny doors that were at the front of Television Centre back then, and being like, wow, like, I'm in the BBC. And I thought it was so cool. And I remember vividly my mum turning to me and saying, oh, well, maybe you'll work here one day. And I remember at the time thinking, you know, you're 9 years old or something. I was like, oh, no, I could never be able to do something that cool. And then, you know, fast forward a few years and I got a job. I got a job as a PA. And I was working to the head of the sort of events, educational events and outreach department. And I wasn't doing that very long before I ended up sort of going to work on the events. And I worked running these events for the BBC, sort of, or working on these big teams that ran these events for the BBC for a couple of years. And we would go on tour every summer around the country, and we'd sort of like turn up in a town and put up this big marquee and have a massive stage and put on these shows and with presenters from TV, and we'd get all the public to come along. And it was an incredible experience. Like, I really loved I actually really loved meeting the people who watched the programmes, because actually when you're inside working at the BBC, you're sort of making stuff, you're creating stuff, and you're putting stuff out there. You don't really know what anyone thinks of it because you're just sort of in the office. So I really enjoyed that. I really kind of enjoyed hearing from people about what they liked about the programme or what they liked about the events and things that we were doing. But after a few years of that, I began to realise that I wasn't necessarily fulfilled, I think, or not completely doing that. It was something that came very naturally because, you know, putting on stage shows was something I'd done a lot through my degree and even outside of that. But I wasn't feeling that creative. So I decided that maybe I would want to try and move into getting a job in television.
Okay. Now, there's 1,001 threads to pull on there, but I'm pretty sure over around 100 episodes we could look back and the amount of people who could recount a story under the age of 10 of that seed being sown of such a, at the time, maybe not a crazy impactful life experience. You know, you're just enjoying it. It's good fun. But actually, if you look at, I guess, the dominoes that following that, and I think it's really interesting around the whole creativity thing, because a lot of people have that, but they almost go, well, I can't do that for work. That's just a hobby.
Yeah.
So what was that kind of journey like of having almost like a dream role, an opportunity? You've gone and worked for the BBC as opposed to walking around it as a 9-year-old. And then you go, I want more. I want to do more. I want to create more. What does that look like, taking that leap?
Well, I think that was a really sort of interesting and quite challenging thing for me to do, because at the time, even though I'd kind of got this job at the BBC, which I'd always thought I'd wanted, I had this kind of mental barrier, I think, where I just did not believe that I could work in television. Like, it felt like that was something I would enjoy so much and wanted so much that I was like, oh, there's no way I'll be able to do it. And actually, I had a really, really good friend. And at the time, she worked on the TV show that the events I did were linked to. So I got to know her because we would do the events, but as part of the events, we'd use material from the TV show. So I was kind of in contact with a lot of that team. And I remember talking to her and saying, oh, you know, I'd love to work in TV. I'd love to kind of do what you do. And she said to me, well, just do it. Like, you know, just ask the guy who runs the TV show for a job. And I was like, of course I can't do that. I mean, I think part of it is just being British and being like, you can't do that. You know, like, it's quite, back then I was, you know, I probably am still sometimes reserved, maybe. But I think I was very, like, you know, quite intimidated by that idea. And it's something you sort of have to get over in TV. You're constantly asking people for jobs when you start out on TV, because that's the only way you get a job. But she was like, yeah, you should just ask him. And I just thought, oh no, I can't do it. I can't do it. I can't do it. But we would keep talking. She would keep encouraging me. And eventually I plucked up the courage and I emailed him and I said, oh, you know, do you think we could have a coffee? I'd like to sort of ask you about, you know, maybe working on the TV show. And he said, yeah, of course. And we had a coffee. And he was a really lovely guy. I'd known him for a couple of years by then because I'd been doing these events. And he knew that I was like a hard worker. He knew that I was sort of very sort of had lots of initiative and was kind of always kind of interested in trying to sort of learn on the job. And I sort of said to him, well, you know, I'd really like to know if I could have a job on your TV show. And he was like, oh yeah, you know, I would have thought we could probably do something, you know, have a look at it. I'm sure we could make something happen. And then he said to me, what did you study out of interest? And I said to him, oh, I've got a degree in drama and I've got an MA in Chinese studies. And he actually laughed out loud, like proper belly laughed out loud. And I was like, this is my first ever TV job interview. And he's laughing at me. Is that a good sign? I'm not quite sure. I was like, oh, have I just un-got the job? Like, just by having this ridiculous background. But thankfully, he hadn't un-given me the job. And that's how I got my first job in TV. And I was absolutely terrified because I had no idea what I was doing. But, you know, I guess because I'd worked in events first, I was like a little bit older than most of the kind of new researchers who were coming into TV and sort of having their first jobs in TV. But I also felt like I just had less of a clue. Like, I don't know, I just felt like everyone else around me, like it was obvious to them what you had to do to make a TV show, and I had no idea. But I was really, really lucky to be paired with the director, who is now one of my very, very close friends. We just hit it off immediately. Super gracious person and just really, just a huge champion of people. Like, there's no one like him. He's a wonderful guy called James W. Newton. And yeah, we've been friends for many, many years now. But he was the director and he was brilliant at like being very gracious when I had no idea what I was doing. And so being really clear about, you know, can you do this, this and this? But also really pushing me and sort of encouraging me to sort of use a camera, even though I was terrified of using a camera, and to, you know, set up really big, quite complicated sequences where we were filming on a, you know, a race down a beach in Kent. And like, you know, I had no idea what I was doing and we were getting jibs and six cameras and all this kind of stuff. My inexperience didn't bother him. He didn't, you know, I think a lot of the time in television, you meet people in management positions who are worried about taking a risk on people because, you know, if that goes wrong, then they might, it could end up making them look bad. But he was just never worried about taking a risk on someone. He would always give you a chance and always encourage you. And so that was a big factor. I have to say that before I asked for the job interview, I kind of realized that I wanted to work in TV. So I persuaded my then boss to let me go on a camera course. Because I'd never used a camera. I had no idea what I was doing. And he let me go on this like 2-day camera course. And it was so long ago that we were still filming on tapes, these little tapes. And the cameras, you know, they didn't have interchangeable lenses. It was so old school. And basically the course, you know, it's sort of, they teach you that you like sit there in the morning and they sort of tell you what all the different buttons on the camera do. And there's like 100 buttons. So you're kind of like, well, you've certainly told me what all of them do, but I cannot remember any of it. And then you have to go and learn and you kind of learn about how to shoot a sequence. And, you know, but it's literally the most basic thing in the world. And from there, I started making my own little films for the BBC website for my boss. I can't believe he let me do it because they were so bad. They were so terrible. If I watched them now, I would literally die because they're so bad. But I just really wanted to learn. I really wanted to know if it was something I could do. And I thought, well, I'll just try it. I had a really supportive boss and he was like, yeah, go for it. So I did. And it's probably really cringe. If I ever find them, I'll just not want to watch it.
So there's a few things there. I think people taking risks on you taking a risk yourself to step outside that comfort zone. And I think you said the word fear in there. And I think that's a really interesting piece because we had a psychologist on 20 or so episodes ago, works in Formula One and with Olympic athletes and stuff. And he said that people who make big leaps in their life think that people who are where they want to be operate there in the absence of fear, and they don't. They just become comfortable with absorbing it and taking a step forwards, even though it's there. And I think that's quite a journey to get to that point where if you think of yourself in your first role on that first day to each of the steps along the way, you were acquiring more and more tools and skills and becoming more comfortable. So from there, how did it, I guess, spiral out into the journey of the adventures you've been on since? Because even that on its own, I'm sure, is a massive leap from where you were at that point.
Yeah, I mean, I think your point about fear is really interesting because I think I was reflecting on this recently that I often feel in my work completely out of my depth. You know, I end, in the years that followed that first job, you know, I ended up doing all kinds, everything from sort of, you know, interviewing NASA scientists to following search and rescue workers into a hurricane to, you know, filming with the Met Police for a year, going on armed raids, you know, literally all kinds of crazy stuff. And when I look back at the person I was when I sort of left university and didn't know what I wanted to do, didn't know if I could do what I wanted to do. Because I think there is a slight difference. Like, I sort of didn't know what I wanted to do, but the inklings that I had were that I wanted to do stuff that I just didn't think I could do. I didn't think I was capable of. But hilariously, I guess around that same time when I was moving from sort of what seemed like the safe events world that I knew and understood into filmmaking, I had sort of a few other life experiences. And what I kind of remember really vividly making this decision, I was like, I'm just going to start doing things that scare me. I remember making that decision. And I remember, like, a few months later, I happened to be at this like natural history museum in Oxford, and I was working there on an event before I moved to TV, and the guy who worked there was like, oh, you know, do you want to come and see like behind the scenes in the Natural History Museum? And I was like, that's so cool, like, who gets to do that? This is a beautiful museum in Oxford, it's amazing. So he took us on this behind the scenes tour, and part of the tour was their office where they kept all the little animals that they would use during like kids' school days, school visits and stuff. And one of the things they had like hissing cockroaches and all these kind of crazy things. One of the things they had was a tarantula, and they were like, do you guys want to hold the tarantula? And I was like, obviously not, like, no way. Like, I was terrified of spiders, tarantulas, ew, like, absolutely no way. And then I remembered in my brain, I was like, but Nat, you said you were going to start doing things that scared you. And then I was like, oh no, why did I ever make that stupid promise to myself? Like, what have I done? And so I kind of was like, well, I think I need to hold the tarantula. So I did, for about like 4 seconds, and then I was like, get it off me, because I was so scared. but I was like, okay, you did that, you survived, you didn't die, okay, you can do this, like, you can do these things that scare you. And I think one of the things that is so key, or one of the things I've learned in my career about, like, if you're going to do something that scares you, if you're going to do something that's really hard, and I think this is the case whenever you're starting a new project, whenever I'm starting a new project, there's always something about it where you're like, wow, that's the bit that's going to be a real challenge on this, and it's kind of scary. But I think there's this, you know, if you have this environment, if you're working in an environment where it's okay to fail, it makes it so much easier to take those risks that feel scary. And sometimes you're not. Sometimes you have to do it scared. And I do that a lot. and I suppose, you know, each program I made after that first one was different, and it came with its own challenges, and found myself in all kinds of crazy places around the world. And that I think I learned a lot just by constantly doing it and finding a way through. And I think what I really enjoy about doing stuff that I find hard is that, like, I do feel like I surprise myself. Which is quite nice. I'm like, oh, I kind of underestimate myself, I think, quite a lot. And so, yeah, doing those things that I'm like, well, I've taken this job, but how on earth am I going to do it? that's my whole vibe. I think it's one of the things that I find so satisfying.
You mentioned there around adventures and ending up in weird and wonderful places, and we'll come onto that in a sec, because I'm curious of, I guess, your personal experience of breaking through some of the barriers to get to that point, because we've talked about the fear factor when it comes to, I guess, the personal journey, but some of the cultural things that were in place in TV over the last 30, 20, 10 years have slowly been evolving. But obviously you've come through that and had to kind of break through some of those barriers. So just take us through kind of your personal experiences of what that was like going into the TV world and coming up against some of the hurdles.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had no idea what I was in for, to be honest. I thought the hardest thing about making TV would be, I don't know how to make TV and I need to learn on the job. But actually, on that very first job, actually, we had an amazing time. You know, we went to all kinds of crazy places doing all kinds of crazy things. But one of the things we did, we flew to Norway, and we had to go and film on this oil rig off the coast of Norway in the middle of the winter, and there was like snow blowing everywhere. We were traveling this helicopter. It was all very exciting, but it was also like quite daunting because you're like, we've got one day on this oil rig and we've got the time between the helicopter lands and it takes off again a few hours later, and we've got to get the content. So it's quite high stress. But we landed, it was, you know, beautiful in the middle of the sea, absolutely beautiful location. And we were like unpacking all the kit, and I was, you know, it was probably like my first or second shoot ever. I don't really know what's going on. And the cameraman starts unpacking all the kit and the sound he's setting up. And I'm talking to James, the director, about, you know, what we're going to do and all this kind of stuff. You know, what do we want to shoot first, and getting the presenter ready. And as the cameraman was unpacking his kit, he sort of started telling all the stories of the shoot he'd just come back from. So he'd just flown down from the Arctic. You know, we're in Northern Norway, so it wasn't far to come. Just flown back from the Arctic. He'd been on a Top Gear shoot, and he was saying how he felt really strongly that you shouldn't be allowed to film in the polar regions unless you can grow hair on your face. And I was standing there, you know, I was like early 20s, very green, had no idea really about TV or about filming or about going to the Arctic or anything. And I was kind of just thought to myself, oh gosh, like, is there something defective about me, like as a female human, that means that I couldn't go to the Arctic and make a TV program? Like, I must be, I when things like that happen, my brain just can't really compute it. Because on the one hand, I have all these incredibly capable, accomplished women in my life who do things which I'm like, most people, you know, you would think they're superhuman with what they achieve. And then you come up against these attitudes which are just said with such authority. And yet I have no understanding of why or where that came from. And obviously now I've shot two films in Antarctica. My first one was completely solo. And so I've obviously proven him wrong. But at the time I was really taken aback, and I just thought, gosh, like, maybe being in this industry is too hard. Maybe, you know, it was always going to be hard because I didn't know what I was doing. But actually, maybe there is something fundamentally wrong with me as a female that means I can't do this. But I have quite a strong mother, and I just feel like she would never take that. I don't think I was really raised to be like, oh, right, yeah. So I just kind of was like, well, generally when I hear stuff like that, I'm kind of like, well, I'll just prove you wrong because I'm not having that. But it does, but I do always doubt myself as well. Like, it does make you doubt yourself.
It's very interesting because quite a few episodes now, maybe 30 or so ago, we've had a few of the Red Arrows pilots on over the years, and one of them was the former captain. And he said he got turned away from flight school three times because he told he wasn't good enough. Mm. And he says, now in my older, wiser self looking back, he said, I didn't take no for an answer. Mm-hmm. And I had people around him supporting him to not take no for an answer. But he does question whether that early experience completely shaped the rest of the journey, because if you'd have stopped at that point, you wouldn't be sitting here now. So can there be, I guess, advice to other people out there? Because I'm sure there's a lot of people, especially who have not got that experience. We talked about some of the technical aspects of them not having the experience, but not having the cultural experience, TV or any other industry, turning up on day one and getting a little bit of a shock. What would your advice be to people that are trying to, you know, challenge some of those stigmas?
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because I had exactly the same experience. You know, a few years into my career, I decided I wanted to move away from making science films and move towards making sort of observational documentary films. And I managed to get an interview with a recruiter for the BBC documentary unit. And I was so excited because I was like, this is my big break. This is the one. This is going to get me my dream job. And I spent like half an hour telling her all the ways and reasons that they should hire me. And I'd been like spending years like getting all the skills, upskilling, fulfilling all the criteria I knew they wanted. And I'd spent years trying to work towards it. And I talked and talked. And then when I finally shut up, she basically just looked at me in the eye and said, you'll never work in documentaries. And I honestly was like devastated. That day, I think, was probably one of the hardest in my career because I felt like I'd worked so hard. I felt like I'd fought so hard. I'd fought loads of stuff, you know, like this guy and his crazy ideas. But you fight so hard when you start on TV. You're constantly working like insane hours. You're constantly delivering stuff that seems impossible. Like, you know, someone will say to you, oh, I need access to a North Sea oil rig next week. Like, if anyone's ever dealt with an oil company press office, you'll know that that's an insane thing to ask. But you keep on delivering these like crazy, crazy things. And so to get there and feel like you've worked so hard and you've put so much into it and then to be told that will never happen was awful. And it was, I actually went for a coffee with James Newton, my friend, after that interview, and I said to him, James, I think I'm going to quit TV. Like, I just can't take this anymore. This is ridiculous. And he was like, no, don't quit. You can make documentaries, just do it without them. And I was just like, I'm not sure. I don't know if I've got it in me. You know, I was so sort of beaten down by the fight by that point. I think sometimes it's really helpful having someone else to keep the faith and someone else who believes in you. And so I did just keep going. And I think for people that coming into the industry, like so often you will meet people who are like, no, you're not right. No, you can't do it. No, you don't have the right skills. And I guess I just have to say, like, carry on. You know, I think my gut, when I came out of that job interview, my gut feeling was like, how dare you be the one, just you're one person. How dare you say I'll never work in documentaries? Like, you don't have that power over me. You don't have, I'm not going to let you have that control over me. Like, that's not okay. And obviously, it could well have ended up being true. I could be sitting here now telling you that, yeah, that's why I'm now an accountant. Obviously, I'm not, because I wouldn't be good at that. But yeah, I was just like, I just didn't like the idea that this one person could determine my future and could tell me that I wasn't allowed to do what I wanted to do.
There's so many stories I've come across over the years, both on the podcast but also on ones that I've heard. And recently I was watching Ed Sheeran's Disney documentary, and in there he says occasionally at industry events he crosses paths with the executives that said, you're never going to make it as a musician. And he said, I don't say anything, but I see them and go, you know, and I know you were wrong.
Yeah.
And do you have, I'm really keen to come on to like some of the incredible places you've been and stories you've told. So do you have almost that internal dialogue with yourself going, almost like your internal cheerleader going, you can do this, you are doing it, I will prove them wrong?
Well, I wouldn't say that I do actually. No, I don't ever think, oh, I'll prove you guys wrong, because I'm always like worried that I won't and they'll be right and I will be wrong. But I think that one of the things that I have learned actually is from the first ever film that I directed. So this covers both the questions, because it's also somewhere cool that I went. So for years I had been, I think I'd sort of hit what felt like a glass ceiling. Like and you know, this is just my opinion, but I do think it is sometimes harder for women to break through into directing than it is for men. I think I have often seen my male counterparts being trusted more quickly to direct and to shoot than I have my female counterparts. And I think there's a whole load of reasons for that, which we maybe talk about later. But I was finding it really hard to move from producing. I was an amazing producer. And the problem is, when you find an amazing producer, no one actually wants to let them direct, because it's really helpful to have an amazing producer. But I was desperate to direct. And then I got a phone call one day. It was a voicemail, actually, from an old boss of mine. And he left his voicemail message, which was basically like, yeah, I need someone to go to Antarctica for 3 months on their own to shoot a film for BBC Two. Could you let me know by tomorrow lunchtime? And I kind of had this realization. I was like, I think this is my chance. I was like, I've been finding it so hard to get anyone to let me direct a film. This feels like my only opportunity. But also, I would have to go to Antarctica on my own for 3 months to make this film. And I have no idea what I'm doing. You know, I've never shot a film before, let alone an hour, let alone done it on my own. I was like, I have to say yes to this, but also I am terrified, because I think I might mess this up really badly because I don't know what I'm doing. So I went to Antarctica, and I was well aware, I actually knew that two of my male friends who were already directing and had been directing for a long time had both been offered that job before I was, and basically neither of them could go for like sort of family reasons. But I got to Antarctica, and it was really hard first couple of weeks. Like, there was so much going on. I was supposed to be shooting this film about a British Antarctic Survey research base that needed to be moved because there was a big crevasse that was going to come straight past the base, and they had to move it to a safer location. And by the time I landed, like, the project was in full swing and there was so much going on, and there were like 70 odd people and one of me, and it was so hard to work out what was happening because the plan changed every 5 minutes, and there were just so many challenges, and I constantly felt like I was almost like climbing up a sand dune. You know, you're just like, your feet are constantly moving, but you're not getting any further up. And that kind of went on for 2 weeks. I just was constantly felt like I wasn't making any progress, and I wasn't shooting anything good or useful. I wasn't telling the story well. And I was just in the back of my head, I constantly had this voice, which was like, oh, you know, if Ben or James were here, they'd know what to do. They'd be making all the right decisions. They'd have got loads of really good footage. They would be doing this really well. And I just was like really stressing out. And then after about 2 weeks of that, I just had to have a word with myself. I just said, like, Nat, you're going to send yourself mad if you carry on like this. You need to accept that Ben and James aren't here. Like, you're the only one that's here. And actually, yes, Ben and James might have done this differently, and they might have filmed it differently, they might have asked different questions, but your voice is also valid. Like, the way you see this story, the way you understand these people, the way you understand the situation, and what you think it says about the world is also valid. It might not be the same as them. It might be. Who knows? It's valid. And I think for me, that was such a formative experience as a filmmaker, because when you're creating a piece of work, there are so many ways you could do it. And there are so many things that you may or may not like, or someone watching it may or may not like, and you will never be able to please everyone. But I think for me, the pieces of work that I watch, which I find most interesting and most engaging, I think are the ones where someone has got something to say and they are saying it. And they're just, you know, this is me, this is my voice, this is what I have to say. So I try and do that. It's hard sometimes because, you know, often if you're making films for broadcasters, they've got ideas as well. And you're sort of always trying to look for the places where they overlap and align. So it's not straightforward necessarily. But I think for me, that is my guiding principle when I'm making work, is like, your voice is valid. Like, what you think is worth something. And that was counterintuitive for me, I think.
So I'm curious as to how that confidence develops to get to that point, because very rarely is that a single moment that gives you that confidence. You know, that's a portfolio of evidence that you build up over time. So I know everyone in their own way experiences some form of imposter syndrome, but has there been a moment on your journey so far where you went, I belong here. I'm good enough for this position and I'm comfortable, almost self-validating it, if that makes sense?
That's a really good question.
Or are you not there yet?
I don't know. I think that sort of yes and no, because I think that my voice is valid, and I think that it is worthwhile. I think one of the things I'm really passionate about actually is having more female voices in the film and TV industry, because actually, you know, they did a study a few years ago where I think it was around 73% of factual TV was being made by male directors. And I think that sometimes I feel like there's just so much of the same voice and the same perspective coming across on our screens. And I think that's often why myself as a female director, I think that is one of the things that makes me a bit like, oh, should I be here? Because there's not as many people who look like me necessarily making films. But I do think it's also why I feel it's so important to keep doing that. I don't think I ever feel I'm absolutely right to be here and I've arrived and I've landed and everything's brilliant and I will always be making brilliant work. But I do think that it's right that I'm trying. And I think another aspect of that is kind of like, every project I do, I'm really aware that it's actually not just about me, and it's not about whether I should be doing this or not, whether I've arrived or not. Usually it's about the people I'm filming. And so when I do projects, one of the biggest thoughts in my head is like, am I reflecting these people's experience with integrity and in a way that does them justice? Like, that's really important to me, and it's something I really try hard to do, and I think it's something that's actually very difficult to do. So I think that's another thing that makes me always think, you know, I think that's one of the things that also makes me not necessarily feel like I'm always supposed to be here, because I always feel like I'm invading someone else's story, you know? And I don't ever want to get to a place where I'm like, I am right all the time and this is just about me.
But that's ultimately, that's traits of humility and being a good person of and not being arrogant. But equally, I think there comes a point where if you removed, I guess, the context from it of your name and stuff like that, and actually wrote out the list of the places you've been, the stories you've told, the feedback you've got, and at the end of the day, in a kind of industry where you are judged on your work, if you weren't any good at your job, you wouldn't keep getting invited back to do more work. So the recurring story there kind of speaks for itself a little bit. But I guess I want to dive into a little bit more of the lighter stuff, in the sense of having gone most places many of us dream of, you know, so many of us sit at home and watch these incredible documentaries. What are the standout bits for you? What do you look back and go, that was incredible? That moment, that experience will stay with me for the rest of my life.
That's a really good question. And there's probably loads and loads of them. I think probably one of the moments that is etched in my brain forever is actually at the start of my first film about Antarctica. It was called Antarctica Ice Station Rescue, and it was a Horizon on BBC Two. And at the very beginning of the film, there's this shot of, it's shot out the front of the plane that I was flying to Antarctica on. And you basically just see this kind of grey shadow coming over white ice. And so I was filming that at the front of the plane, but it was also projected onto a big screen inside the plane. And I'd sort of left this camera running, so I was sitting in my seat and I was watching this shot as we landed in Antarctica, just this sort of big grey shadow sort of drifting over the white ice. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, okay, right, so that's the ice. And, you know, I'm sure we were kept being told we were landing at an airport base, and I was like, all right, cool, so soon we'll see tarmac. all the buildings. No, I knew it was a blue ice runway, but I was like, there'll be the buildings and there'll be, you know, the infrastructure, and, you know, we're not in the sticks quite yet. And then I saw the shadow appear and I was like, oh no, we're much closer to the ground than I thought we were. And oh look, there's two shipping containers, and that is the airbase. Like, that is it. Like, those two shipping containers, that's our destination. And I was like, oh my goodness, because they tell you when you go to Antarctica, you have to obviously sign all these waivers and things, but they also say to you, just so you know, you're not coming home until the date on your plane ticket. So my plane ticket was like out on this day, and my plane ticket home was 3 months later. And they were like, even if something happens to your family members, there's a disaster at home, you won't be coming back, because there are so few planes and so few seats on flights. Like, your plane ticket 3 months later, that's when you're coming home. And, you know, in winter, they say it's easier to get back from the ISS than it is to get from Antarctica. So you kind of have this drummed into you. And then as I landed, I just thought, what have I done? I was just like, what have you got yourself into? Like, you're here for 3 months on your own with this bunch of people that you don't know. You don't know any of these people. And you're completely on your own. Why have you done this? And I suppose I really remember that memory, because the next moment I had a choice to make. I could either just like fall apart and be like, oh my gosh, or I could be like, right, okay, let's do this. Like, let's see what you can squeeze out of this experience. Like, how much life can you squeeze out of this experience? Like, how can you lean into this? Like, lean into the fear, lean into the not knowing, lean into all of this stuff that scares you, and just see where it could take you. See what you could do with it.
I want to jump onto something in a sec, but before it goes out of my mind, I remember having a conversation with Brad, a kind of a mutual friend for us, and talking about what was it like being a polar explorer 100 years ago. And he said the best way of describing it was that once you were out of shouting distance, that was the end of the communication. Mm-hmm. So if someone said, we'd pick you up from here in a year, they would pick you up from here in a year. And there's that feeling of isolation. And I think that links on to where my mind was going next, that is there, we're in a very hyper-connected world. We're used to having everything on tap. If I click something on my laptop today, it'll be here tomorrow. Is there a wisdom or an experience that you take from being in such isolation that the vast majority of the population can never get their head around, because they'll never experience that?
Yeah, I think that I think there have been three particular expeditions that I've done. So the first one was an expedition in the Yukon with Dan Snow and Felicity Aston and Kevin Fong for programs for BBC Two. So we did a month-long expedition in the Yukon and sort of the Alaska into the Yukon in the Canadian wilderness. My first trip to Antarctica and then my second trip to Antarctica. And I'd say there's probably graduations of communication. So on the Yukon trip, there was basically no cell reception for like big chunks of it, none at all. In my first trip to Antarctica, the internet connection was so bad that there was no cell reception. The internet was like dial up, so you just didn't bother. So there was, again, you're almost completely cut off. And this final trip to Antarctica, there's actually like, we had Wi-Fi, so you could WhatsApp, but it was so hard to call home. Like it was just like, yeah. So a lot of the time you just had no communications. And honestly, having time without my mobile phone was so precious. They are some of the most precious weeks of my life. I remember being in the Canadian wilderness and we were wild camping at the side of the Yukon River and I hadn't had phone signal for like 5 days and I just was so peaceful. Even though I was working like 18-hour days, getting about 4 hours sleep a night and getting rained on all day or being chased by bears or whatever. But I felt so peaceful because you just live in the moment. And I think the other thing that I love about those situations and particularly about filming in extreme environments is like your relationships with people. And I'm really interested in how people behave and respond in those situations because you do have all your home comforts stripped away, all the sort of things that we usually rely on either for physical help or for emotional, mental kind of help are all gone. And it's just humans stripped bare you get to know each other and you get to understand each other better and you understand yourself better. And I think for me those things are really precious, and I would encourage everyone to go and camp in the Canadian wilderness. Although me and my friend did who was working on that job with me, we did have a conversation about whether you should brush your teeth before you go to bed, because all of the briefing you get before you go into the Canadian wilderness is bears love toothpaste because they can smell it. And so we were like, well, why would we ever brush our teeth before we go to bed? Because won't they just come and eat us?
Not many people having that conversation. I remember I was fortunate enough to do an expedition to Canada when I was 13, and the ranger that we had kind of supporting us said, do not keep food in your tents because the bears will find it. And we were like, ha 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 ha. And he opened up this thing at the back of his trunk and there was a blooming great rifle there, and he said, do not keep any food in your tents or I will having to be used this. And we were, from that point on, it was, oh yeah, this is quite an experience. But I guess you must have had the vast majority of people never get to have that sort of experience, but then kind of be almost being parachuted out of that back to normal life. How do you almost ping pong from one to the other? Because that must be a shock state almost of one extreme to the other.
Yeah, it's really, I think particularly with Antarctica, like I've got a lot of friends who work with British Antarctic Survey. And in fact, one of the brilliant, absolutely brilliant guy who works with British Antarctic Survey called Pete Bucktrout, who's an amazing photographer and he does loads of their videography and stuff for them. And I remember when I was coming back from that first trip and he said, you know, it might take you a bit of time to adjust. And I literally sat in a room on my own for 2 weeks when I got back from that first trip, because it was such an intense experience being away for 3 months, but not just being away for 3 months, but being cut off from the world, basically. I mean, you didn't have TV or radio, like nothing. The internet was so bad that nobody bothered to use it. You got, they do like a little newspaper that they print out at lunchtime or morning coffee. So you can read the news if you want to, but generally people don't. When they're in Antarctica, because actually you learn to lean into the isolation and being cut off, and you realize how nice it is to not have the news. It's like really good for your mental health. But coming back to it is utterly overwhelming. I remember flying back from Antarctica. I flew to Chile and then had to fly from Chile to Spain and then Spain to London. But I remember flying into Chile. And, you know, obviously you fly over Antarctica and then you fly over the sea and then you start landing in Chile. And I remember seeing a car park and roads and thinking, oh my goodness, what are these things? You know, I'd forgotten about them. I hadn't seen them for so long. And it's overwhelming. Everything feels new again. Everything's very strange. And I think also, I think part of the reason I sort of just wanted to sit on my own in a room for 2 weeks was because you were living in dorms in Antarctica. You know, you're living on top of each other. You're with people 24/7 for 3 months. And I find that quite exhausting, not having any time on your own. And so when I got home, I was just like, I just want to be on my own. I just want to like sit quietly and stare at a wall and remember what it's like for it to be quiet and not to have to say anything. So yeah, it does take quite a lot of time to adjust. I think it's also hard for people back home because you get home and all you can talk about is Antarctica and they're just like, shut up, stop talking about it. So I remember, yeah, you sort of have to self-censor. Just like, you haven't got any other stories, so you just have to shut up sometimes because people will get annoyed.
It's almost like time traveling, because even if you went back 40 years, you know, to our parents and our parents' parents, and you have conversations with them about how stuff's moved on, we can't transport ourselves back 40 years, but there are spots on Earth now where, you know, I hear it quite a lot of, whether it's, you know, quite affluent people or people who work in high-pressure jobs, or I've heard of a couple of Premier League football managers who have done it, and they'll do these kind of escape camps where you go to for a week and you hand your phone in and you go up into a treetop and you stay there for a week and just have a week of peace.
Wow.
But it's mad that we've almost become so desensitized to how connected we are that we have to fly halfway across the world to find somewhere we can actually do that.
Yeah.
We're very fortunate, obviously, living in the UK, and there are so many places that, again, during the pandemic, a lot of people did explore because they had no other options. But actually going, wow, there's so much open space and places you can go and things you can see. So I guess this is, although obviously it's work for you, it must have really shaped the kind of trajectory of your life and the way that you value different aspects of your life.
Yeah. Do you know what? this is like, it feels quite embarrassing to say this now, but that first expedition that I did with Dan Snow and like loads of us who went on that expedition are still friends, and we hang out and catch up, and it's so wonderful. Before I took that job, I genuinely hated camping, like hated it, hated the idea. Like, I'd never done an expedition. I'd always thought, like, why would you want to do that? Like, I just was not interested at all. I know, don't tell anyone, I'm just telling everyone. I just really was just not, if you'd said to my mum, like, before that, oh yeah, Nat's going to go camping, she'd have been like, what? No, she isn't. But just before that, I'd been on a job where I'd been filming up in Alaska, in the Alaskan wilderness, for like a couple of months in the middle of winter. And it was absolutely incredible, like so beautiful. And I'd loved how remote it was. And I'd surprised myself with how much I'd enjoyed that. And I'd only taken that job because I was trying to get a job in documentaries and I knew I needed these skills that I could get on that job. And I was like, I don't really want to have to be outside in the snow for 2 months, but I need these skills, so I'm going to do it. And then I was so surprised at how much I enjoyed it. So then when this exhibition came up, I was like, okay, well, I enjoyed that. I know I'm not a huge camper, but maybe I'll like this. Maybe there's something else I can learn from this. And that's always going through my head, even now, whenever I consider like what work I want to do and what I want to make, it's always like, what do I want to learn? What can I learn from this? How will this shape me potentially? And I think hilariously, again, when we were on that expedition in the Yukon, we had two polar explorers with us. So we had an amazing woman called Felicity Aston, who's a British polar explorer. She was one of the presenters. And then we had one of our guides was a great Canadian guy called Devin McDermott, who's probably guided more people to the South Pole than anyone else on Earth. Like, he's an extremely experienced polar guy. And we would, because we had no phones with us in the evenings, we'd sit around the campfire, you know, after a long day of filming, you put the cameras on charge, you'll sit around the campfire and eat. And then they would start telling stories about Antarctica. And I genuinely would sit there being like, why would anyone want to go there? It sounds awful. Like, Felicity's stories were like, yeah, I was on this expedition and someone pooed in the toilet and didn't flush it properly and the whole thing froze. And then we had a frozen poo toilet. And I was just like, I mean, this sounds awful. Why would you ever want to go to this awful place? And then within like 4 months, I had a plane ticket. Yeah, so I think I'm my own worst enemy in that sense.
You mentioned earlier around the International Space Station thing, and I've heard that a number of times where people are feel more connected up there, and because of, you know, commercial space flight and those sorts of things, it actually is becoming a hyper connected place compared to the ability to access Alaska, and obviously the weather windows and all those sorts of things make it a real challenge. I've got a couple of things just to kind of pull all this together. There's obviously we're in a much more digital world than we've ever been, and there's a lot of people who are creating content in whatever sphere that looks like for them. And I think there was a stat recently that if pre-GCSE age, 7 out of 10 youngsters want to be YouTubers. So we talk about a world of youngsters that are going to be creatives and going into content creation, but there's also a lot of people out there who are going, that'd be nice, but I don't know if that's actually going to be a career for me, but I am really passionate about it. So if you are that person who's got the understanding that you're a creative, you love doing things and you love getting out there and trying stuff and challenging yourself, but you don't know what that first step looks like, what would your advice be now, having gone through and taken the leap so many times?
Yeah, I mean, I think I would say start making stuff, because I think sometimes when you start doing that, you learn what you do and don't like, or what comes to you naturally, or what interests you most. Start making stuff. I think start talking to people, like try and talk to people who do the job you want to do, or the job you think you want to do, or a whole bunch of different jobs, because you don't know which one you want to do. Ask them what they do, ask them what their job is, ask them like how it works, and what a day looks like, or what a week looks like. And so I would say that. And then I would say, like, what I did was I just said yes to stuff. I just like tried to find opportunities, and I just tried things. So when I got my first job at the BBC and I ended up working in events, like, I didn't know if I would like that or not. I knew I could do it, but I didn't know if I'd like it. And it turned out that I liked it a bit, but I didn't like it completely. And so then I was like, well, I'll try learning how to film things. Will I like that? And I learned how to film things, and I went and worked on a TV show, and I did like it. And I was like, okay, now what about if I tried a different TV show? Like, do I like that more or less? You know, and so at no point did I have like a plan. Sorry, everyone, to burst that bubble. But I want to try things, and I hope that through trying, I will learn both about myself, about the world around me, about the industry, about what the options are or aren't. I think that would be it, because I think so often, like, especially for me, that journey and learning, taking those steps, has formed who I am today, and it's made me the filmmaker that I am today. I don't think I could have fast forwarded to this point, as much as I would have loved to. I would have loved to been 18 and been like, okay, I know that I want to go and direct films, because I could have skipped out a bunch of stuff and done this a lot earlier and maybe had fun and whatever. But I actually think that those steps were really valuable, because they taught me loads of stuff that someone who hasn't taken those steps might learn later or in a different time. So now I see the journey as really valuable. I don't think I would have done if I was 18 and you told me, yeah, by the way, you've got to do that first and then do this and then do this and then do this. And then all these years later, you'll end up making films. I'd have been like, oh, can't I just go straight there? Like, I know that's what I want to do. I think the journey is valuable.
Okay. And then my final question. I know you watched Barrett's interview before we did this today, and it was a question that I kind of stumbled upon, but actually it was a real moment for him when I asked him it. So let's say you reach the end of your career, 10, 20, 30, 40 years time. What would Nat in that situation say to you right now?
Oh, that's a really good question. I think probably, like, don't sweat it. I care so much about like my work that I can get really like stressed about stuff. Like, I really worry about things. I think partly it's because I know that I'm dealing with other people's stories, and I really want to deal with them with integrity and respect. Like, that is so important to me, and I feel a real burden. And I also I feel quite acutely aware that not everyone in the media does treat people in that way. And so I do, and you often rub up against that. You know, so often I will meet people and they have got very bad things to say about the media and about filming, and often they'll be quite, you know, have bad things to say about me filming them, even though they don't know me, they don't know what I'm making, you know. So I spend a lot of my time trying to help people understand the difference between a documentary filmmaker, a news journalist, a journalist from some other kind of organization, you know, a YouTuber. Like, there are really significant differences between all those things. And so that's something that you're constantly having to navigate. But I think, yeah, because I really care about the things that I make, I can just get a bit like, I actually had an old boss of mine said, Nat, you need to care less. And I was like, I don't know if I can. But that's probably what I would say to myself. And I think also, I would just be so interested to have that perspective. It's something I've been thinking about a lot recently, actually, is like, the longer you're in the industry, you know, sort of like the older, the uglier you become, you kind of feel like you've seen it all before. And that is a much, that's quite a helpful thing when you're constantly coming up against these challenges that feel really big. I think it's that sort of having that more bird's eye view perspective of like, this is a project in amongst, you know, a whole body of work. And sometimes you'll be really pleased with the film that you make and sometimes you won't. And that's okay. Like, I probably don't feel like it's okay at the time because I'm like, oh, I really wanted it to be like this or this. Or, but yeah, I think we were talking a little bit before we started recording, just not every single thing is going to be perfect. That's okay. Because you learn, as long as I'm learning, that's my main thing. As long as I'm learning. Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, it's a lovely way to pull it together. And it's, we're going to stick a pin in it because we're going to revisit this when more content comes out in the next year,
yes,
which
indeed.
We won't say much more about now. But Nat, it's been absolutely fantastic. Thank you so much for sharing so much depth about your journey and so much of the lessons learned, because I know there's a lot of young people out there absorbing this content and actually going, wow, that could be me. And I'm sure you've given a lot of young people a lot of confidence there. So thank you.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been so fun.
Thank you again to Nat there for sharing her story and giving us such a fantastic insight into her industry and the challenges that she's had along the way. Plenty of great advice there for people to take away. You can find out more about Nat in the show notes and connect with her on socials. And we will be sharing some more time with Nat next year to explore one of her incredible adventures that has recently come to a close in Antarctica and that is currently in post-production. So stay tuned for that. Make sure you've hit subscribe as it really does help the show, and the link to our Etsy print store is in the show notes. I hope you enjoyed our conversation today and will be joining us again soon for another episode of the Rogue Monkey Podcast.